Open our Bibles to the 12th chapter of Joshua. Joshua chapter 12. We're going to be coming up to the point tonight where they actually are going into the land and dividing out the various parcels to the 12 tribes. The battles have been fought, as we saw last week. They've conquered their enemy. They have, in some cases, had total victory. In other cases, they just kind of pushed them back some. But it says, chapter 12 starts off with kind of a little bit of rehearsing, a little review of the various kings that were conquered in the process. And it begins with some battles that had taken place before they actually, when they were still under the leadership of Moses. And it says, these are the kings of the land whom the children of Israel defeated, and whose land they possessed on the other side of the Jordan toward the rising of the sun, from the river Arnon to Mount Hermon on the eastern Jordan plain. One king was Sihon of the Amorites, who dwelt in Heshbon and ruled half of Gilead from Aroer, which is on the bank of the river Arnon, from the middle of the river, even as far as the river Jabbok, which is at the border of the Ammonites, and the eastern Jordan plain from the Sea of Chinnereth, which is the Sea of Galilee, as far as the Sea of Arabah, which it says here, the Salt Sea, or it's what we commonly know as the Dead Sea. The road to Beth Sheshemoth, and the southwards below the slopes of Pisgah. The other king was Og, king of Bashan, and his territory, who was of the remnant of the giants, who dwelt in Ashtaroth and Edrei, and reigned over Mount Hermon, over Salca, over all Bashan, as far as the border of the Geshurites and the Maachathites, and over half of Gilead to the border of Sihon, the king of Heshbon. And these Moses, the servant of the Lord, and the children of Israel had conquered, and Moses, the servant of the Lord, had given as a possession to the Reubenites, Gadites, and half-tribe of Manasseh. So what we're going to look at, first of all, is the parceling out of the land on the Trans-Jordan side, or the area would be today the area of Jordan. And these two guys that are listed here, we read about them in the book of Numbers, around chapter 21. They were a couple of pretty powerful kings. They were pretty established, pretty mighty kings, Og and Sihon. We've seen them mentioned several times in the book of Joshua so far, even though the battles had already been fought. In fact, these battles, these victories over these two kings are something that gets repeated throughout the Old Testament. The Psalms mentions them, and oftentimes as God is trying to remind Israel of the victories that he's brought them, these two kings are always mentioned. In Deuteronomy chapter 3, verse 11, it says that Og's bedstead measured 13 and a half feet long and 6 feet wide. I mean, that was the measurement of his bed. You know, it says here in our text that he ruled over this group of giants. And I know there are a lot of people that kind of wonder about the reality of that. I mean, just sometimes you know, when we talk of giants today, we'll think of maybe some NBA player or Shaquille or somebody like that, you know, or Andre or something. We think of those as being modern-day giants. And then we think that the ones of the Bible are somewhat exaggerated, that they use somewhat of hyperbole. But there is something from archaeology that kind of bears a lot of witness to this. This is a picture of what's called a dolmen. And dolmens range, you find them all the way from Ireland to India, and from Russia all the way down to Yemen. I mean, they're throughout all of Europe and Asia, and they're basically, they're monolithic graves. They're just, the monolith is just something made out of huge stones, kind of like Stonehenge, you know, that's considered a monolith. And these dolmens are graves that are made out of the big stones where you've got stones that border it, and then there's a big table stone that goes over across the top of it. And what's interesting about this area of Bashan, this is actually a picture that I took there in Israel a few years ago, and there's several dolmens there, and the ones there measure between 12 and 15 feet from the head to the bottom. Why would they make these things that big if they didn't have something that big to put in them? You know, the dolmens throughout the rest of the world are not that size at all. In fact, they're actually fairly compact. But the ones throughout this area of kind of the eastern side of Galilee at the foothills of the Golan Heights, they are mostly over 12 feet in length. It says, these are the kings of the country verse 7, which Joshua and the children of Israel conquered on this side of the Jordan, on the west from Baal Gad in the valley of Lebanon, as far as Mount Helek, and the ascent to Seir, which Joshua gave to the tribes of Israel as a possession according to the divisions. In the mountain country, the lowlands, the Jordan plain, the slopes, wilderness, and in the south, the Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. Now, these places and these names probably don't mean anything to us because we're several centuries and several thousand miles removed from it. You know, if we were the ones going into the land and we were the ones that having to deal with all of these ites and all of these and having to inherit and be receive some of these parcels of land, it would mean a lot to us. And so he's kind of given the description of some of these places that they took. And as he's kind of given this thumbnail, the area of Israel is really amazingly small. The you know, if you've seen pictures of it, I mean, it's fairly narrow country. At its widest point, it's probably about the distance from El Reno to Shawnee here in Oklahoma. And that's at its widest point. For the most part, it's much, much narrower than that. And the length from north to south is about the distance of the longest north and south distance of Oklahoma. It's not a very large country at all, and yet it's got such a diverse environment. There's mountainous forested areas, there's lush pasture land, there's desert area. It's a very diverse place for such a small country. And so he's describing all of these different areas that they took. And it says in verse 9, as he's continuing giving the descriptions of the people that they've conquered, it says there was the king of Jericho, he was one. The king of Ai, which is beside Bethel, that was another one. The king of Jerusalem alone, one. Or the king of Jerusalem, one. The king of Hebron, one. The king of Jarmuth, one. The king of Lachish, one. The king of Eglon, one. The king of Gezer, one. King of Debir, one. King of Gedor, one. You think, why didn't he just say, we beat all these guys? You could have saved a lot of parchment, could have saved me a lot of embarrassment trying to pronounce them, and we could have gotten through the Bible study a lot more quickly. But he goes on. He says, the king of Hormah won, the king of Arad won, and I think I left out the king of Gedor won, the king of Libna won, the king of Adullam won, the king of Makeda won, the king of Bethel won, king of Tapua won, the king of Hefer won, the king of Aphek won, the king of Lasharon won. And then you got Madon and Hetzor and Shimron, Meron, Achfes, Shef, Taanach, Megiddo, I know that one, Kiddush, Jokneam in Carmel, and the king of Dor. I pronounced that one correctly. And just so we know, it's in the heights of Dor. And then there's the king of the people of Gilgal, and the king of Tirzah, all of the kings, 31. So Moses defeated two of them, and under Joshua's leadership, they defeated 31. He very specifically lets us know that all of the kings of this area, which basically, for the most part, these kings were like glorified mayors. You know, they ruled over city-states. They'd have a walled city and then the surrounding areas, and they were called kings. With a few exceptions, that was the case. But they took them all. Now, obviously, you're going through your morning devos and you come to this section, you've got this tremendous tendency to just kind of gloss over the names and just move on down to something of substance, you know. And I understand that. I get that. And you know, it may be boring to read all the names, but the thing that we don't want to do is gloss over the significance of them. The idea that these are listed here very specifically, and he even adds one at the end, just so you know, these were real guys. These were historic dudes. This isn't something that somebody just thunked up somewhere and added to the list. But the Holy Spirit goes to extreme measures to make sure that we understand that these guys were real and they were all defeated. And we don't want to gloss over. We don't want to miss the significance of it. Alan Redpath, who was probably, I think, one of the greatest representatives of the church of the 20th century. For many years, he was a pastor at Moody Church back in the 60s. And just a tremendous scholar, tremendous man of God. He went home to be with the Lord about 20 years ago. But he said this about that. He says, sometimes in the course of human experience, it's good to sit down and reflect on what has been conquered by the grace of God. And, you know, it's the Lord wants us to know. He wants them to know. He's reminding them the reason why he goes over all of this list. And he says, there was this king. Yeah, that was one. There was this king. That was another one. There was this king. And we're going to add him to the list. Because he wants them to not just think, well, I allowed you to be victorious. But I want you to think of every specific time when I did. I don't want you to just think of it in some sort of a lump sort of thing. I want you to think of it in a very specific kind of thing. Because the reason is, we forget. And life happens, and we start going through trials, and we start feeling like we're not victorious. We start thinking that, I guess that abundant life is for other people. I see them walking, you know, and they're kind of like got a little pep in their step as they go along, and they're whistling a tune, but that ain't me. And so we start thinking that we've been forgotten, or we've been left behind, or we're not good enough, or something like that. And it's good, I think. Sometimes it's really good for us to think of the kings that he's defeated in our lives. I mean, your list of kings would be different than my list of kings, I know. But the times when I start feeling like I can't do it, the times when I start feeling like I just, you know, I might as well cash it in, I might as well give up, all I need to do is start thinking about the times when he's been, well, there was that king one, and then there was that king one, and then there was that king one. I don't know what kind of struggles or what kind of battles you might be facing today, but I do know this. There is nothing that is greater than what God can overcome. You know, you might be battling struggles with your flesh. You might be battling things at work. Or you might be overcome by certain things like finances or just trying to make the pieces fit together. You might be having troubles in your home. Whatever it is, that king that has that dominance, the one that is squatting on that territory that God has promised and already given to you, he's defeated. As he told them last week, I've already given it into your land, or into your hands. And I don't know that there's ever an appropriate time to quote a Queen song from the pulpit, but we could just say, and another one down, and another one down, and another one bites the dust. You know what I'm saying? And I think that's why he lists all of them here in chapter 12. Now, in chapter 13, it says, now Joshua was old and advanced in years. If you got the old King James, it says he was stricken in years. And the Lord said to him, being the encourager that he is, he says, dude, you're old and you're stricken in years. You know, he said, man, I remember when you didn't look anything like this when you first started. Look at you now, you know. I mean, most of the Bible guys think that he was probably around 100 at this time. You know, we were talking about that, I think, after the Bible study last week. We're going to learn later that Caleb is 85 after the battles, after they go into land and then they fight the battles. He's 85. But most of the commentators I read estimated, we don't have any way of knowing for sure, but most of them estimated he was somewhere around 100. So I think we can probably just sort of lose that idea of he got this John Derrick look going on, you know, like from the movie. That's probably not too accurate. He's old and he's advanced in years, and the Lord made sure he understood it too. He says, man, you're up there. And then notice what he says after that, but you ain't done yet. There's very much of the land yet to be possessed. I don't know about you, but sometimes that kind of bums me out. That kind of bothers me. I understand the baptism of the Holy Spirit. I understand the idea that the victory is already ours, that God has accomplished everything for us, that this promised land life is ours, and it's just ours for the taking. We just got to go get it. And I understand that we're not passive in it. I do understand he's given us, but we got to go fight the battles. We've got to go take it. We got to be proactive in the process. And I understand that he's faithful and that he will strengthen us and that he will provide for us all of the way. I've been teaching this for many years, and I understand it in my life. And yet I still get discouraged. Because I look at where I should be. I've been walking with the Lord now for over three decades, and pretty soberly, pretty straightforwardly, and I've sat under the teachings of some tremendous spiritual giants, and I've been fed the Bible in a very clear and systematic and healthy, balanced way. I should be a lot further down the road than what I am. I should be a lot more spiritual. I should be a lot closer to Christ. I should have more victory. I should have more of that possession that has already been given to me than what I have. And that can be somewhat discouraging sometimes. Because I want to be perfect, and I want to be perfect now. You know what I mean? I want all of that now. I don't want to wait for it. And I think there seems to be somewhat of a tension. There seems to be somewhat, maybe even a balance between as the Lord told them, because we know this is something that's done on the Holy Spirit's timetable. It's His pace. He knows, and He's the one that gets it done. And there's some sort of a tension between the fact that He's given it to us. It's already ours. He even says, past tense, I have given it to you. And then what He said to them back in the book of Deuteronomy before they ever came into land, He told them, He was kind of preparing them for it, and He told them what it was going to be like. Or, I'm sorry, Exodus chapter 23, it says, starting with verse 27, and I will send my fear before you, and I will cause confusion among all the people to whom you come. And I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. And I'll send hornets before you, which will drive out the Hivite and the Canaanite and the Hittite from before you. But I won't drive them out before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. Little by little I will drive them out from before you until you have increased and inherit the land. You know, God in His sovereignty and in His wisdom, He's telling them, He said, I'm going to give it to you. It's all yours. It's your possession. It's already a done deal. But don't think it's going to happen overnight. Because if you just went in there and drove them all out tomorrow before you had a chance to settle the country, then the wild beasts would come and they would take over, and then you'd have other battles to fight. You know, sometimes we think that we should be have more going on than what we do. I can remember sitting in a pastor's conference many years ago, and this was kind of right at the time when Calvary Chapel was like on the front page of all the magazines, and everybody was talking about some of these churches on the coast that had just exploded from Bible study to 2,000 or 3,000 in a matter of a year, and all this sort of thing, and all this was happening. And one of the pastors was talking at a pastor's conference 1 year, and he says, "If tomorrow you had 2,000 people in your church, could you handle it?" And I remember thinking, "No, no, I don't think I'm ready. I'm not prepared yet. I'm not established enough to do something like that." So I think that there is some wisdom in the Lord of that we do have that frustration where we want to be further down the road, we want to be more spiritual, we want to be more of having grabbed it than what sometimes we want to possess more than we have in our hands when it comes to spiritual matters. But it happens in His timing. And He says, the work's not done yet, Joshua. I know you're old, but there's still a lot more to do. This is the land that still yet remains. All the territory of the Philistines, which would basically be the Gaza Strip today. All that of the Geshurites from Sihor, which is east of Egypt, as far as the border of Ekron northward, which is counted as Canaanite. You got the five lords of the Philistines, and then He mentions those five guys. And then from the south, all the land of the Canaanites. And then He mentions these other places. All the way up to Lebanon, He says. So there, it's basically the coastal area from the Wadi of Egypt down in the Sinai all the way up to Tyre and Sidon area of Lebanon. All of that coastal region, the Sharon Plain area, is still under the others in control. And He says here in the last part of verse 6, He says, I will drive them out from before the children of Israel, only divide it by lot to Israel as an inheritance, as I've commanded you. Now, therefore, divide this land as an inheritance to the 9.5 tribes of Manasseh. You know, there were two things that the Israelites never did accomplish. And I think one of them is they never did realize their full borders. They never did take all of the land that God had promised them. And I think one of the reasons for that is that we understand that it's something that we can't do. It's something that God does, and so it's in His timing, and so we're not going to get it all now, as we were discussing earlier. And then we get comfortable with what we do have. We think we've pushed the enemy out just enough. We've got just enough breathing room. We've got some elbow room. We've got a little room to expand. And that's enough. We don't have to deal with all of the battles. We don't have to defeat all of the kings. We don't have to have all of the victory. We've got enough. And then the second thing that they never accomplished is that they never expunged the land from its idols. You know, when you read in the books of the kings, you'll find that, especially with the kings of Judah, the southern kingdom, they'll say, oftentimes they'll have this line associated with them. When this new king would rise, and then there's a little one or two verse synopsis of his reign, and it'll say at the end of it, it says, "And he did that which was right in the eyes of the Lord, except that he did not destroy the high places." And there's always that caveat. You know, he did things really well. He did pretty good. He brought about all these reforms and everything, but he still allowed those pagan centers of worship to be established in the land. He didn't destroy the high places. And I think we can do that a lot in our lives, in our walks. We can have this thing that's going pretty good. We're rocking pretty steady. We're involved in church, and we've got a Devo thing happening, and we're listening to Christian music, and we're going to all of these sort of things. But there's these high places. There's these things that we don't deal with, that we allow that foothold of the enemy to still maintain. That's the way it was with the Israelites. I mean, it's good that you're not hitting your wife anymore. That's a good thing. Now why don't you start loving her as Christ loves the church? You know, we do that sometimes. We think, I'm not as bad as I used to be. I know I could be better, but I'm not as bad as I used to be. I mean, I used to do this, and now I'm only doing that half as much as I used to, you know? I mean, it's good that you don't run the jerk off that cuts you off in traffic. Now let's try smiling at him and praying for him. I know you could be a lot worse, but we could be a lot better, couldn't we? You know, and it's not willpower. It's not something that we do in our own strength. If there's anything that we've learned from our texts and from our own lives, it's that. You know, it's not something that we can conjure or muster up ourselves. But it's just simply an acknowledgement that it's the right thing to do. We can't because we're dead. You know, we can't do that. I can't be love my wife as Christ loved the church. I can't be nice to the idiot on the road. I can't do those sort of things because I'm dead. But I can because he's alive in me. And he says, so you're going to divide this between the 9.5 tribes on the west side of the Jordan, and the other half tribe of the Reubenites and the Gadites received their inheritance, which Moses had given them beyond the Jordan eastward, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had given them from Aroah, which is the bank of the Arnon. He describes all these different places and on the Trans-Jordan side, these areas such as Gilead and it's basically modern-day Jordan. I mean, the Trans-Jordan area at this time, which today is the country of Jordan, and then southern parts of Syria, in those days was basically five kingdoms. You had Edom in the south, Moab to the east of the Dead Sea, Ammon just above that, kind of straight east of Jerusalem area. The modern-day city of Amman, Jordan, is named from the Ammonites. And then above that, you had the hills of Gilead, very lush pasture land, and then you've heard of the bulls of Bashan because it was such great pasture land. And even today, you'll see cattle grazing on the hills of Bashan in the springtime. These were the areas that the 2.5 tribes, there was Reuben and Gad and then the half tribe of Manasseh, as they were coming through the land, they say, "We like this place. We want to stay here." And it says, nevertheless, though, even though, so Moses said, he went to God, and God said, yeah, if they want to have this Trans-Jordan side, that's okay. They can do that. They just have to go help you guys fight the battles on the other side. And it says, but nevertheless, verse 13, the children of Israel did not drive out the Geshurites or the Maacathites, but the Geshurites and the Maacathites dwell among the Israelites until this day. You know, not only had they somewhat kind of sort of settled for God's best, where they said, we don't really care about the other side of the land, other side of the river, we like this land just fine. It's got good pasture land. We want to stay here. But then they became complacent in what they had there and didn't even take it to its full extent of what God had given them. You know, it was today we use the term, we will describe it as, we'll divide God's will into his perfect will and his permissive will. You know, and the things that he will permit us to do, because it falls underneath this umbrella of grace, and it's not really sin, but it's really not what he would want us to do. It's not his perfect will for us, but it's his permissive will. And that's kind of how these guys were. You know, they wanted his, they longed for his permissive will rather than his perfect will. They were the guys that would be concerned with well, is it a sin to, and then, you know, fill in the blank. They would be the guys that would ask that question. Rather than seeing how far they could run from it, they would see how close they could get to it. And they never did drive out the Geshurites or these other guys, however you say that word. It's interesting, Geshur was the ancestral home of Absalom's mother. You know, David took several wives to himself, and one of his wives was from Geshur, and her son was Absalom. In fact, when he started putting together his rebellion against his father David, that's where he went to go. He went to, because, you know, he had a grandma up there, grandpa. And so he went to Geshur and hid out there while he was putting together his rebellion. And then right after that was squelched, after Absalom failed and was killed in battle, then there was another guy, kind of a little short lived story of a guy by the name of Sheba that tried to lead the 10 tribes in rebellion. You remember that from 2 Samuel chapter 20. And he sought refuge when his rebellion failed. He went to Maaca for refuge. Because these were a couple of strongholds in the land. These were a couple of places where, that they never had gained the victory completely. And so when there was trouble, that's where the enemy found a foothold. And then he says in verse 14, only to the tribe of Levi he had given no inheritance. The sacrifices of the Lord God of Israel made by fire are their inheritance, as he said to them. He had promised them he's going to divide the land among all the tribes except for Israel. And they're going to get instead cities. There's going to be 43 cities that are given to them. We'll look at that actually in a couple of weeks. The Lord was to be their inheritance, not the land. They were the land was given to the tribes as an inheritance, as a visible promise of God's provision. But the Levites were supposed to just trust that God was their provision. You know, his name was Jehovah Jireh to them, which means the Lord is our provider. And it says, and then Moses had given, this is in verse 15, Moses had given to the tribe of the children of Israel, so the area that was Moab in those days was given to Reuben as an inheritance according to his families. And their territory was from Aroer, which is on the bank of the river Arnon, so on and so forth. Heshbon and all its cities in the plain. And then there's Dibon and all these other places. You pronounce them. I'm not going to go there. Just a whole list of people, of places that they had conquered in the process to give this area to Reuben. It says the children of Israel, verse 22, also killed with the sword Baalim, the son of Beor, the soothsayer among those who were killed by them. You know, we read about this in the book of Numbers, where Baalim was this kind of a weird dude. I mean, he's a guy that's hard to pigeonhole. He was says that he was a prophet of the Lord. And he did prophesy for the Lord, but he didn't care about the things of the Lord. He was totally in it for the money. And it says he was killed in the process. And it says, verse 23, the border of the children of Reuben was the bank of the Jordan, and this was the inheritance of the children of Reuben according to their families, cities, and their villages. And then next, as they continue moving up, we get to the tribe of Gad, and they were given the area of Gilead and Heshbon, or Ammon, and it says, Moses had given an inheritance to the tribe of Gad, to the children of Gad, according to their families. Their territory was Jazer, all the cities of Gilead, and half the land of the Ammonites, as far as this really funny sounding river or area, which is before Rabbah. And from Heshbon and then all these other places, and continues to go all of these other names that I'm not going to mention, all the way up to the Sea of Chinnereth, which is the Sea of Galilee. and then got the Jordan side, Jordan River on the west, and says this inheritance of the children of Gad according to the family cities and their villages. And then moving on up from there to the area of Bashan, there was the half-tribe of Manasseh that settled in the area essentially east of Galilee and then on up into the Golan. Moses had also given an inheritance to half the tribe of Manasseh, and it was for half the tribe of the children of Manasseh according to their families. And the territory from Hanaim, and then lists all Bashan and these other cities, and this is where he goes in. That's when King Og of Bashan was, that was one of the people that they defeated up in that area. And verse 32, these are the areas which Moses had distributed as an inheritance in the plains of Moab on the other side of the Jordan by Jericho eastward. Now, something that's interesting, and we're going to see this in a minute, but something that I want to draw attention to now is that these lands were not divided by lot. Okay, when they go on the west side of the Jordan, when they actually go into the land of Canaan, and they divide the land up among those 9.5 remaining tribes, they cast lots for it. We'll talk about that in a minute. But it was basically a way of determining the Lord's will. These guys didn't do that. It doesn't say why, by what means they used. We don't know what the criteria was, but it was as though, it wasn't distributed by lot, and it was as though they were saying, we're going to trust ourselves. We'll determine our borders. We'll determine our boundaries. We're going to trust ourselves. We don't need to trust in the Lord. We don't need to wait for Him to speak. We'll just go through and do this. Not that what they did was bad. It may very well have been very close to the borders that they would have gotten had they cast lots. We don't know that. But it was something that they did of the flesh. I'm convinced of that. Alan Redpath, that I was talking about earlier, he gives in his testimony, he got saved as a young man, a teenager, and then he went away to college. And when he was going to university, he did as so many students do when they get caught up in a university lifestyle and everything, and this is during the 20s with the bear coats and this goldfish swallowing and all this, and he got caught up into all that, and it wasn't like he turned into this wanton hedonistic kind of party animal. He just allowed things in the world to come in and crowd out his life and take precedence over his life. It wasn't that he was doing anything overtly wrong. It was just that he was doing what he wanted to do, when he wanted to do it, and how he wanted to do it. He'd go to church when there wasn't something else going on. He would get involved if it seemed like something that would strike his fancy. But his devotional life was waning, and his relationship with the Lord was waning. And there was a man that I think, if I remember, it might even be the guy that led him to the Lord, but there was he had a mentor that was kind of observing this, watching this in his life. And one day he was talking to him, and he says, Alan, what do you think it's like for a man to have a saved soul and a wasted life? And he just let that question fall on him. And Alan says that it began haunting him every night as he's going to bed. Those words would just keep, five words, saved soul and wasted life, saved soul and wasted life, just keep repeating over and over in his head. And he couldn't sleep, couldn't get any peace. And he finally came to the place where he had to deal with it, and he had to finally surrender to the Lord. Well, I think that pretty much characterizes these 2.5 tribes. It's not that what they did was overtly wrong. It's just what they did was what they wanted to do, which is what the Bible calls operating in the flesh. It doesn't have to be bad to be in the flesh. It just means you leave God out of the equation. And it appears as though that's what they've done here. And so it says no tribe was given to the no inheritance was given to the tribe of Levi because he would be their inheritance. We'll cover that later. 48 Levitical cities they were given. Six of which were the cities of refuge. It says in verse 1 of chapter 14, these are the areas which the children of Israel inherited in the land of Canaan. So, okay, that's the Transjordan side. That's modern-day Jordan, southern Syria. We covered that. Now we're going to go across the river, and we're going to cover what would be today Israel. And it says these are the areas which were inherited in the land of Canaan, which Eleazar the priest, Joshua the son of Nun, and the heads of the fathers of the tribes of the children of Israel distributed as an inheritance to them. Their inheritance was by lot, as the Lord had commanded by the hand of Moses for the nine tribes and a half tribe. You know, it says there's several places where the Bible addresses this, but I think Proverbs 16:33 is the most well-known and the most outward in it. It says, the lot is cast in the lap, but every decision is from the Lord. Now, when they cast lots, I don't know if they drew straws, if they had, threw dice. I don't know how they did it, but there was some sort of a lottery kind of system. There was some sort of a outwardly appearing random sort of a thing that they believed God was in, that God was going to determine his will through this casting of the lot. As I was reading some of the commentators, and I said, read many of them where they said, yeah, that's the way they did it back then, but today we don't do it that way. And I'm okay with that. I'm fine with that. If that's, I don't do it that way. So if somebody says, is it wrong to do it that way? Probably not, as long as you're willing to accept the outcome. If you say, okay, God, should I buy this car or not buy this car? I'm going to flip a coin, and then I'm going to let be it determined in the lot. If heads I buy it, tails I don't buy it. And so you flip it and it comes up tails, and then you go, well, how about two out of three? If we're going to approach it that way, then I would say, no, you probably don't want to do it. But if you're going to accept the outcome, if that's the way you want to determine God's will and you can take it to the bank when you're done, then go for it. Says, for Moses had given the inheritance to the two tribes and the half-tribe on the other side of the Jordan, but the Levites he gave no inheritance among them, for the children of Joseph were two tribes. So what he's going to explain here, okay, you got 12 sons of Joseph, they make up the 12 tribes. All right, so that's why you got 12 parcels of land. But the Levites didn't get one, so that only leaves 11 parcels of land, but you got 12 parcels with 11 tribes. What do you do with that? And so he's explaining that. He said, for the children of Joseph were two tribes, Manasseh and Ephraim. If you remember the story in the closing chapters of Genesis, Joseph's two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, were essentially adopted by Jacob and given, basically he got the double portion by his sons inheriting the double on his behalf. And so they filled up the missing tribe with Levi's absence. And they gave no part to the Levites in the land except cities to dwell in, with their common lands as for their livestock and their property, as the Lord had commanded Moses. So the children of Israel did, and they divided the land. And then the children of Judah came to Joshua in Gilgal. So the first land they're going to do, just as they did from the south to the north, with the Transjordan side, they're going to go from south to the north on this side. And the very first one they deal with is Joshua, or Judah. And they're getting ready to divide up the land by Joshua. They were actually going to believe that God was in the lot, that he was going to determine the lot, and that the tribes that needed more land, that had more people, would get a bigger lot, and the tribes that needed less land, had less people, they would get a smaller lot. And that's exactly the way it worked out. And so before they do Joshua, it says, Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said to him, and so remember Caleb, he was one of the guys that, one of the 12 tribe spies that went into the land. This is 45 years earlier, and they had gone into the land and spied it out, and he and Joshua were the only two that came back with the positive story. And it says that Joshua, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, came to him. And there's somewhat of a debate, and I'm not real sure which side to come down on this, but there is somewhat of a question as to whether or not Caleb was actually Jewish or not. The Kenizzites, the descendants of Kenaz, were not Jewish. They were a very close association. They were descendants of Esau, and they became integrated into the tribe of Judah at a very early stage. And so some people believe that may be what the case. They were just basically a proselyte that came in. There also could be another Kenaz that he was a descendant from, who was a descendant of Judah. So the debate's still out on that. But it's interesting that he was, as he gives his genealogy, it says that he was a son of Jephunneh, who was a Kenizzite. And he said to him, you know the word which the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, concerning you and me in Kadesh Barnea. He said, you know, he remembered that there was this word that had been given him, this promise that had been given him years ago when they had taken that, or when they had gone in to spy out the land, and this area of southern Judah is where they went to. And they all came back and they said, you know what? That's a really lush land. I mean, it takes two people to carry a cluster of grapes. It truly is a land flowing with milk and honey, but those guys are giants. And we're grasshoppers. I mean, those dudes are like 12 to 15 feet tall, you know. And so the 10 guys, 10 of the 12 said, we can't do it. Joshua and Caleb said, the bigger they are, the harder they're going to fall. You know, God's already given it to us. We can get it. And he made a deal with Moses back then, and he just kind of reminding Joshua now about this deal that Caleb says, okay, when we go into the land, that's what I want. I want this area right here, that place we saw. And Moses promised it to him. You can imagine what it would have been like him for 40 years as they're wandering around in the desert and all the complaining and the murmuring that the people did. And all the time he's thinking, you know what? If you'd have just trusted God, we'd be out of this place. And yet he kept his eyes on the prize. He kept his eyes focused on the goal. He knew that it's not mine today, but tomorrow it's going to be mine. And for him, tomorrow was 45 years later. I don't know if you ever heard of Adoniram Judson. He was one of the first American missionaries, one of the first Americans to actually go. He started this missionary society, this Baptist missionary society, and it was in the early 1800s that he went to the area of Burma, a place where they had never seen white people before. And he labored for 12 years without a single convert. And there were people that were concerned with him, for him, wondering if he wouldn't get discouraged. And somebody asked him one time, he says, what does the future hold for the Burmese mission? And with sparkling eyes and a pep in his step, he said, the future of the Burmese mission is as bright as the promises of God. He says, I don't know when that first convert's going to come. I don't know. His plan, his goal was to have 100 churches. Or I have a church with 100 people. He wanted to have a church with 100 people, and he wanted to translate the Bible into the Burmese language. By the time he died, there were 100 churches with 8,000 members. And he did finish the translation. In fact, almost had a Burmese English dictionary finished before he died. After this 12 years of struggle and going into areas where they'd never seen a white person before, they started going into this very remote area up in the mountains that inhabited by these people called the Karen people. Who had this unbroken, they called it the tradition of the elders, but they had this unbroken oral tradition that went all the way back to the flood. They had the story of the flood. They had the story of Adam and Eve. They had the story of Satan coming to deceiving them and causing the fall and the curse. And they had this unbroken tradition of the God, the Creator, and the promise that someday he would send a Messiah who would bring them the holy parchments that would share his words with him. And so when Judson and his coworker, when they first got in, let me tell you about the gospel. Whole villages would get converted. I said, man, we've been waiting for you. What took you so long? In fact, Burma has the third highest population of Baptists in the world. Burma. You've got the United States and India and Burma. That's how effective mission was before he was done. And so Caleb says, I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land and brought back word to him as was in my heart. You know, what was that word that was in his heart? You know, the future of Israel is as bright as the promises of God. That's what he brought back. But nevertheless, my brethren who went up with me made the heart of my people melt. But I wholly followed the Lord my God. I got that underlined. You know, the 10 spies focused on their circumstances, but Joshua and Caleb focused on the unbroken promises of God. And so Moses swore that day, saying, surely the land where your foot has trodden shall be your inheritance and your children's forever, because you have wholly followed the Lord my God. And now, behold, the Lord has kept me alive, as he said, these 45 years, ever since The Lord spoke this word to Moses when Israel was wandering in the wilderness. And now here I am this day, 85 years old. Happy birthday, Caleb. As yet I am as strong this day as the day that Moses sent me, just as my strength was then, is now, for strength for war, for going out and for coming in. He says, I can swing a sword today just as easy as I could 40 years ago. 85 years old, and he's still ready to do battle. He says, so now therefore, verse 12, give me this mountain which the Lord spoke in that day, as you heard in that day how the Anakim were there. We talked about the Anakim last week, the descendants of Anak. These were the giants of the land. That the cities were great and fortified. It may be that the Lord will be with me, and I shall drive them out of this land, as the Lord said. You know, he had a bumper sticker on the back of his car that said, no fear. Okay, he didn't have a car. He had a bumper sticker on the rear, no, a rumper sticker on his donkey that said, ain't scared, because he's a mountain man. You know, he said, ain't scared. And it says, Joshua blessed him and gave to Hebron to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, as an inheritance. And Hebron, therefore, became an inheritance of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, to this day, because he wholly followed the Lord his God. And the name of Hebron was formerly Kirjath Arba, which means the city of Arba, and Arba was the greatest of the Anakim. So that was formerly known as the headquarters of the giants, is what they're saying there. But now it's known as Hebron. And then the land had rest from war. It used to be known as the stronghold, the center of the giant land. But now it's known as Hebron. Hebron means fellowship or community. And the lesson from chapter 14 is that when we wholly follow the Lord our God, when we surrender to Him, when we take that stand, as we just sang about, we'll have fellowship with God. And it'll be that unbroken, unfettered, unadulterated, untainted fellowship that only comes from that consecrated life. God, we long for that. We desire that. Show us those kings in our lives that need to be forsaken. Those high places, Lord, that need to be purged. And then by your grace and by the strength of your Spirit, Lord, may we press on and go forward into that sweet, sweet fellowship of Hebron. In Jesus' name, amen.